Oh, good afternoon and good evening and good morning. Again, it's beautiful to be with you again and to, again, see how many places are here. And say hello to Marion in Australia, in Sydney, and to Amy in Nashville, and to Wolf in Eugene, Oregon, and then to Wayne in Fort Lauderdale. And I'm just giving you the names of the people whose names I see here, and I know that in some cases the name that appears on the list is the name of your spouse or significant other or your sister. But in any case, it's completely lovely to be with you. So let's just take a moment to offer our practice, and you can find a posture that's strong for you and comfortable. And inhale with the feeling that you're inhaling into the sit bones and allowing them to become heavy. Exhaling with the sense that the breath comes all the way up to the crown. And we'll take a deep breath in and exhaling, breathe out whatever feels like extra in the pure experience of our own awareness, that is thoughts, memories, all the things that we hang on to in the course of a day. And with the exhalation, we just sigh it all out. We offer our practice asking that it be of benefit to all beings and to the earth. We offer our practice asking that all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. We ask that all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. We ask that all beings know the sacred joy that lies beyond suffering. We ask that all beings experience equanimity beyond grasping, hatred, and dullness. We ask to know the equality of all that lives, to recognize how our experience arises and subsides inside that one vast awareness, that consciousness, that chitti shakti, which is seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling through all of our sense organs, creating realities projected from through each mind, creating this universe of individual and collective experience, and realizing herself as this through each of us. So this is our Sunday Q&A session. It's wonderful to be with you. And before we take live questions, Deb, do we have any questions on the website?
Sorry, I had to unmute myself.
Oh, okay.
A little slow on that one. We have a question. First off, to let everybody know, in order to ask a question, just hit star 2, and we will see a hand raised. So just so you, if in case you don't remember that. We have a question from Laurel, and she's going to have to excuse me because some of it came in garbly gook. So it says, so many levels to what you share. Thank you. Just heard, I'm not sure what she heard. It might be the last class. The secret is not to doubt that it is happening. And then, again, not sure what the word is. Would love to feel into this, and until deep awareness remembers this easily. Any clues? I'm not sure if you can decipher that. I was just getting ready to send her a note to see what she meant.
Okay. Maybe she'll send us an answer. I'm going to assume that what she meant, what she's talking about, is the stay where you are without worrying, for the goal is assured epigraph, which was kind of the epigraph of this class. The second part of that statement, as many of you remember, is who but the self could teach this and to whom. So the reason that Abhinava Gupta says stay where you are without worrying, and that I reiterate it, and I have to say that because when I teach this text, or indeed any of the great texts that I have the privilege of getting to talk about with you guys, of course, I always learn as much every time I teach it as you do. And the thing about working with a text that is really the record of the experience and the intellectual understanding of realized beings, one of the things that blows my mind about reading this text, and in fact most of the non-dual tantra, as well as, you know, certain other spiritual texts, is how absolutely they nailed the nature of reality. And by that I'm talking about the power in awareness that this amazing book describes to us. So why should we stay as we are without worrying? Because of two things. First, all of this is really the play of divine awareness, and that includes our fears, our lusts, our greediness, our all the different ways in which we shoot ourselves in the foot and make ourselves suffer on the journey, all the ways in which we try our best to be truly spiritual, defenders of the planet, all the other good things that we would like to be. She is all of this, and she has, whether you know it or not, and when I first heard this teaching, honestly, I didn't know it. So one of the reasons I can say this so confidently is because in the many years I've been practicing with this understanding, I have come to recognize that all of its promises are true, that the goal is assured, that this is the teaching of the self, meaning yourself, myself, the self of the universe, and that once your feet are set on this journey, then you're going to experience the goal of it sooner or later, because what we call the goal is already present, is already in us, is already what we are. And I know that especially in our time, especially if we're involved in the spiritual universe in places like California and Sydney and, you know, other high consciousness places, but pretty much everywhere in the world these days, we have heard this teaching, God is already alive inside you. The self is what you are. Pure awareness is what you are. And in my experience, the thing that holds us back in our journey is not believing that. And of course, to say we don't believe it is usually simply a sign that we haven't really experienced enough evidence that awareness that allows us to experience our life is not only the truth about you and me, it's also the screen on which this entire universe is playing. We do the practice in order to learn how to stay present in that awareness, even when the experience of being a body or the experience of being our thoughts becomes so big that we can't help being bamboozled by it. Nonetheless, over and over and over again, we remind ourselves, oh, wait a minute, I am that which is always present, which knows that I am having these experiences. And sooner or later, we believe it. And that's when we stop worrying, knowing that the goal is assured. So I hope that sort of helps to reassure you, Laurel, and I understand why you might doubt that statement. I know I spent many years thinking, yes, of course, that's what the enlightened beings say, but I don't experience it. I know I have years to go before I get it. Well, maybe you do. but it's also true that in this moment, all that you are is fully present and capable of knowing itself. And very often, the only thing that keeps us from fully recognizing that is worry, not quite being able to believe it. So stay where you are without worrying, because the goal is assured. And nobody speaks these words that we hear and discuss in the Pratyabhijñasaradhyayam. Nobody speaks these words but the voice of Goddess, the voice of the Self, the voice of Shiva. The Self speaking to the Self. The Self drawing the Self towards itself. So I hope that begins to answer your question a bit.
Okay, we have another question from Hira. She asks, what is the difference between being aware of awareness and witnessing the witness state, or are they the same?
They're pretty much the same, except that, again, in my practice experience, there's a stage where you're able to be aware of awareness while walking through your life and very engaged in your life. And the witness, what I think you're calling the witness state, or what I mean by the witness state when I use that word, is actually a stage where your main attention, your main awareness, so to speak, is parked in witness. It's as though the awareness, which we normally experience as the background, comes forward. So instead of being primarily aware of the thoughts and objects, the room, etc., you're primarily aware of that which is the witness, which is holding and containing it. And it's a very different experience than walking around in your so-called normal waking state, while at the same time being aware that there is this knowingness, this witnessingness, this awareness that's allowing experience. So, for instance, at this moment, I am aware of my own awareness, even though I'm also talking to you and I'm involved in talking to you. There's a part of my attention that's aware that there is an awareness that's holding all this. But it's not the same as what I believe you're calling the witness state, in which the experience of being the knower is so much in the foreground that often it feels as though you're not speaking or you're not seeing, that someone else is speaking and seeing. And what you are is that big, vast knowingness that's witnessing it. So yes, they are the same, but they're different levels or different states of witnessing or awareing. Thanks, Hira, for that question.
We've got another one from the web. Gaius says, is the work on emotions with witnessing, devouring them, the same as the process of shamanic energetic cleansing?
You know, I'm not really familiar with the process of shamanic energetic cleansing, so I can't really answer that question. I believe that you know, in many traditions we have methods of cleansing, and I think most of us here on this call have done various cleansing methods. One of the ones that I teach in the Goddess courses is the method of imagining a fire and imagining Goddess Kali dancing in the fire, placing yourself again in imagination in front of the fire and feeling that you draw off cloaks from your body which represent the veils or the cloaks or the energetic blocks. So that's one way of cleansing yourself. There's another practice for cleansing yourself that's taught in the Tibetan tradition, in which you imagine two deities or two Buddhas over your head in union, a masculine and a feminine deity, and the emanation, the combined sexual fluid from their sexual intercourse flows down through your head and cleanses your entire subtle body, and you repeat a mantra as you're having this visualization. So these are types of cleansing that work with the subtle body, the imagination, visualization. The practice of allowing awareness to swallow a samskara is actually, it's a practice where you let yourself feel, to the degree that you're able to, the whole complex of the sensation of an emotion, of a difficult emotion, or of words that have been problematic to you, and you let yourself simultaneously hold the feeling and hold the awareness of awareness, and you kind of bring them together. Whether, you know, you use a visualization, which is what I do often, of holding space around the feeling complex, or whether you just remain aware of awareness and let yourself be fully present with the charged emotion until it dissolves, until it's literally digested by consciousness. And that practice, that very simple tactic of bringing the relatively dense energy of an emotional holding experience with the extremely subtle energy of awareness is, I would say, the direct method for cleansing samskaras. Now, there may be a shamanic practice which is equally direct. I honestly don't know. But in the end, no matter which tradition you're working with, in the end, we sit and watch the process and hold space for it, and experience what to me is a kind of miracle, which is that by holding anything in bare awareness, awareness will digest it, assimilate it, in the words of modern psychology, integrate it into itself, so that your awareness, in a certain sense, is both dissolves the veils or the charged experiences, the unclarity, the pain, the charge. It both dissolves it. It also makes those emotional energies one with itself. And in my intuition, it's the fact that we as individual expressions of divine awareness have lived through the experiences that we've lived through. We've confronted our own creations and the collective creations. We've suffered through them. We've become attached to them. We've enjoyed them. We've been in despair. We've been killed. We've given birth. We've succeeded. We've failed. We've had all these experiences. And now we're being given the chance to digest the residue through these very direct processes. And I do believe that it is through confronting emotional charge with the subtlety and elegance and brilliance and beauty of our own attention, our own awareness, which is goddess, that we self-liberate, that we free ourselves. So thank you for that question.
Okay, we've got someone that has called in. Oh, I just heard him clear their throat. So you're on the spot right now.
Hi, this is Boring in Boston. Thank you.
Hi. Hi.
Sally. Hi. I'm really appreciating these advanced studies and techniques. However, I'm also running into the fact that am somewhat obsessed by Shiva as the destroyer and the game changer, and the fact that the planet seems to be entering into end times, and that I'm just trying to get my head around what it means to really accept the fact that this whole energy field will soon be changing as the planet self-destructs. How are you dealing with it?
How the planet itself is, what was the very last word of that sentence, is struck?
Self-destructs. I mean, we are destroying the...
Okay. Now I understand.
We are living in the matrix.
Yeah, we are. So how I personally deal with it, is that what you're asking? Because I think that depending on our dharma, and depending on on what's being asked of us, really, there are different ways we can deal with it. And one of them, obviously, is extreme activism. You know, it's like we do whatever we can do to ask the grown-ups in the room, by which I mean the mature people in the room, to do what can be done to change the trajectory. And I found it very, very significant that those kids in Florida are holding a rally in which they are saying, you know, stop it. You have to protect, you know, we have to protect the kids. And when kids are talking about not going to school until something is done about guns. I mean, that's, you know, that kind of activism is a very important part of this process for, you know, for doing our best to stop the trajectory. Now, if you are looking at the way things are going and feeling that we are spiraling towards a kind of end time, and that there is a possible holocaust, a possible nuclear holocaust coming, which I assume is what you're thinking about, because I think that is probably the thing that, if we can't avoid it, will, you know, kind of end it here, at least for human beings. Then given the fact that we do not necessarily have the power in the concrete universe to stop that, we do have the power in the internal universe, in the interior universe, to imagine something different. And I do believe that there are a lot of people on this planet who are doing our best to imagine something different and to live as though that imagination were a reality. And I think we need to recognize the power in our own awareness and to, you know, to have the kind of, let's call it faith, shraddha, as the Sanskrit word is, that the shraddha that comes from knowing that your consciousness is not different than Shiva's consciousness, and that if you have enough conviction and enough courage and enough willingness to be in awareness, that you can make a lot of difference. So that's kind of where I'm at. And, you know, the other option, of course, is to do your practice as deeply as you can and identify with awareness as deeply as you can and know that whatever happens, this is not the only planet in the multiverse. There are many layers and realms of reality, and we really have no idea what the end game really is. But, you know, one thing about this view of reality that we're studying is that it's based on the idea that, you know, to put it in very concrete terms, that this universe is made out of God and that God is not going anywhere. So if this universe dissolves, you know, if it ends in fire, chaos, the accumulated rage of all the people who have a lot to be angry about. Nonetheless, it can't end because that out of which it is born and that to which it returns is not is unkillable, can't die, is eternal, is awareness itself. And your awareness is that. So that's in the end where we take refuge. Does that make sense, Laura?
Thank you, Sally. I really appreciate your insights. And for me, I think it's just a matter of keeping on practicing Tonglen and being aware.
Yeah, so right on. Yeah. Yeah. Hello?
Okay, now we'll go to our next question. We have Emmy on the web, and she asks, how do you relate the five acts to a spontaneous experience of enlightenment? How do you relate the five acts to a spontaneous experience of enlightenment download from the divine? She's also wondering if you could talk about the chronological succession of the acts, if there are such a thing, and if the concept of karma. I'm guessing that's what she means. So we need Kali intervention to work with this, and the element of devotion to her to break the spell of the linear time while working with such experience.
That's a big question, a big set of questions.
and she says that her interpretation of your words seems to suggest this route. Could you speak about that a little bit more?
Seems to suggest that we need the grace of Kali to dissolve the dream. Yeah, that is pretty much what Tantra says. So let me try to answer your question in order, and if I miss something, maybe Deb can remind me. So when you have a spontaneous experience of awakening, you are having a spontaneous experience of grace. In other words, this is the fifth act. Grace is the revelation of non-duality, and when the act of grace arises and transforms your vision or your inner experience or even including your outer experience, then within that, the fivefold act keeps on playing. So there is, in any enlightened experience, I'm just gonna pull something out of my own experience, if you will. So one of my experiences that I consider, a spontaneous experience of awakening, I think I've talked about it in this class, happened one day when I was sitting in a room full of people, and it suddenly became obvious that everything that was happening in the room was happening inside this field of very palpable awareness that was me. And that, when someone walked across the room, I could feel their footsteps in my awareness. And when somebody spoke, I could feel their voice tickling my awareness. And the way that worked, so to speak, the way it progressed, is that there would be a manifestation, an action, or I would see something, or someone would do something or say something. It would be manifest, it would be sustained for a while, it would dissolve. But in that particular act, there was no concealment, or to use the technical language of tantric philosophy, the separation was concealed. And what was revealed was the oneness. So in an act of grace, concealment is withdrawn, and revelation comes forward. Whereas in ordinary life, revelation is concealed. That is, we're not able to see that whatever is happening inside one awareness, which is your awareness. But the fivefold act is always going on, manifestation, sustenance, dissolution, at whatever level of experience we are present to. The esoteric part of the fivefold act are the last two, the concealment and revelation parts. And concealment and revelation are mutually exclusive. Where there is concealment, revelation is concealed. Where there's revelation, concealment is not experienced. Though I suppose you could say that since we're hardly ever able to see the entire thing at once, much of reality is always concealed. But in the practice of allowing yourself to experience your life as the unfolding of the fivefold act over and over and over again, what's just very helpful is to investigate how you're experiencing manifestation, the sustaining of a perception or a thought or an experience, the dissolution of it, the way in which the experience is concealed and then held in your consciousness, perhaps as a memory. And then to recognize those moments when there is the aha, the insight arises, all this is a part of me. And that unfolding is going to go on indefinitely, as long as we are existing. So now I've forgotten the second part of the question. Deb?
She asked, I think you answered it all.
Oh, okay.
She's also been wondering, yeah, it sounds like you answered all of it in there. So, all right. So let's take a caller from the web. Carrie, I've unmuted you if you have a question. You had your hand raised.
Yeah. Hi, Sally.
How are you?
I'm good. I am the one who asked about my resistance to my
Yes.
On the list. And I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Yes. So Carrie asked a question on the listserv. Do you want to just say it for everybody? Because not everybody has, you know, been reading the listserv today.
Well, I guess the gist of it is that when I study with you, I feel this sort of ravenousness for the teachings, and I felt that way all the way up to starting this study with you. And then once we started, I had this big resistance to practice itself. And
when you say practice itself, do you mean to sitting down to meditate or to doing the open-eyed practice or to reading, to reading pieces of the text or just the whole thing?
So as much as I seem to be able to do is to sit with you on the call on Wednesday night, listen to that. But mm-hmm. after that, I just can't seem to get myself to sit on my mat or sit in front of my altar and practice or do any of it.
Right, right. So one of the things I said in the note I wrote back to you, and I think Alice said this too, is that it actually is very helpful to have a dialogue with your resistance and get to know it, which you may have done. You know, you may have a very good idea of what resistance is about, because every one of us has some quirky personal reason why we resist practice at a given moment. But what I would say, I want to get kind of hardcore about this. I also want to say, Carrie, I know resistance very well. I have a lot of it myself. And one of the things I have noticed, well, there's a few things I've noticed. One is that because of the fact that consciousness is constantly in a process of expansion and contraction, unmesha nimesha, as the Spandakarika says, you know, we're always some part of our consciousness will expand and then it will contract. It's, you know, we'll have a, you know, a beautiful moment of awakeness and awareness and love, and then almost automatically, a day later or a week later or sometimes even an hour or a minute later, it will feel as though that openness just squeezed itself down into a sort of a raisin-like contraction. Mm-hmm. And one thing that you come to realize over years of practice and self-observation is that this is kind of inevitable. You know, progress is two steps forward, one step back.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems to be the way the world is. So you will be very open and very motivated, and then you'll experience that absolute inability to do whatever it is that you've committed to do. So, yes, did you want to say something to that?
No, I'm just taking it all in. Yeah, I've just been super hard on myself about it.
Well, I would say I would say that's probably the case, and that. That the first step in working with it might just be to say, okay, my awareness is in a contracted phase now, or rather, you know, my motivation for practice is in a contracted phase. So I forgive myself. I understand that this is natural. It's not because I'm, you know, not a good practitioner. It's just something that happens. And it's we really do need to do that. And then here's the other side of it. And again, I'm speaking from years of practice of working with resistance. You have to make some kind of deal with yourself so that you're practicing anyway. Because if you give in to the resistance for longer than, say, 2 or 3 days or a week, you actually take yourself out of the stream of your spiritual unfoldment, and you have to work harder to get yourself back into it. Mm-hmm. And that's just a fact. You know, it's you know, as they have discovered in training athletes, resting from your workout is very important, and the resistance that you feel is often a signal from inside that it's time to rest, that you need some time off. So resistance is to be respected. And at the same time, as you respect your resistance, notice what happens if you let yourself rest for too long. What happens is your muscles atrophy, right, mm-hmm. to some little extent, you know, but meaning your focus muscles atrophy. So we all have to find the sweet spot where we're not pushing ourselves beyond the point where we need to rest because pushing ourselves beyond the point where we need to rest invites burnout, and your enthusiasm will contract, and that's important. It's not a mistake. But then you have to know when to say to yourself, okay, I got to get on the mat today. I don't care how I feel. And the way I recommend doing that is creating a minimum time that you're going to practice and deciding, I'm going to just do this, which could be 5 minutes of meditation after asana. It could be taking a walk with, you know, one of the walking around dharanas. But, you know, discipline consists at that point of saying, okay, I'm not required to do a full hour practice. I don't have to do all this stuff that Sally sends, because truthfully, there's a lot and more than pretty much anyone can do unless you're on a retreat. But I am going to pick one thing this week, and I'm going to do it for 15 minutes every day. And I'm going to do it even if I don't feel like it. And then just notice the process, which may include resistance. It may include, you know, it may feel like you're just struggling to do it, and there's no opening and there's no joy, but you do it. And then, and I'm sure you know this, but I'll say it anyway, that there just comes a point where the current of your practice, the current of your aspiration basically the current of Shakti's desire to expand your consciousness will take over. And you'll find that you want to sit for longer or that you just feel better. And, you know, and then you kind of ease yourself into adding a little bit more, and that's how you work with resistance. So it's a combination of seeing when resistance is a sign that you should back off, and being discerning enough and observant of yourself enough to notice when that natural rest period is leading into a kind of dismissal of your whole practice, and that's when you have to get back on the mat.
Thank you so much.
Carrie, thank you so much. And thank you so much for this question, because this is one of the big questions that every one of us has to deal with. So thank you for bringing it up.
Okay, we have another person on the web, and I think it's Anne in California.
Okay.
Hi, Sally.
How are you, sweetie?
I'm fine. So for a few weeks now, I've been experiencing overwhelming sadness. I can't name what that sadness is about, at least not yet, but I do believe that the sadness is caused by yet to be unnamed samskaras. So I've been working with this in meditation, and the sadness usually dissolves into awareness, at least for a while. But the other day when I sat with it, it just kept getting painfully worse. My heart chakra looked and felt like a bottomless pit of sadness. So I read the Sutra 11 chapter in the Recognition Sutras, where he talks about that beautiful practice of absorbing samskaras into the sushumna.
Right.
So my question is it possible to work with the sadness in the way that he suggests without being able to identify samskaras? Or is there a way to be able to discover what they actually are so that I can work with them?
Again, great question. First of all, it's not necessary to know what the samskaras are, because what matters is the feeling.
Okay.
In other words, anyone who's ever done psychoanalysis, which I know people don't do anymore, but in my day we did, you know, you can figure out everything about where your, at least this life, samskaras come from. It doesn't help. You know, they're still there. So the practice is to feel into the feeling. And then if you're working inside the sushumna nadi, which we actually are going to do in the coming week, then as you feel the sushumna, as you feel yourself settling into the sushumna, just bring the feeling into the sushumna, or just open up your awareness and create some space around it and hold the two together. And a layer of it will dissolve. And I think like most of us, you have lifetimes of sadness. So the thing about what happens when those pockets of sadness come up in the context of what we're doing in this time together, it's almost as though your consciousness says, okay, there's a big Shakti here right now. That means we can stir the pot a bit and I don't want to say get rid of, but dissolve, assimilate, digest a lot of stuff. And sometimes, and for some people in this class, it's anger, because I found that anger, sadness, and fear are the two big, big, deep bedrock emotional pockets that are the main part of the veil that we all carry. And sadness seems to be very much related to anavamala, to that, you know, fundamental sense of separation that, of course, keeps being replicated throughout our lifetimes and all the separations, the losses, the deaths that we go through. So just let yourself be with it. Embrace it. You know, I don't mean embrace it like hug it to yourself and say, I love you, you're mine, please stay with me, but like embrace it the way you embrace one of your kids when they were, you know, crying or sad, and just let that embrace of your awareness dissolve that layer, or let the Sushumnanadi dissolve it. And if insight comes up about what this relates to, which it probably will at different points, then just note that. But you don't need to know.
Okay, that's good. That answers my... That sounds good. Very helpful.
Good. Okay, well, let us know.
Okay.
Okay, sweetie, thank you.
Okay, we have another question from the web. Brenda asks, she says, my question is same or similar to the one posted on the listserv today, which asks, I'm not sure what mantra to be using, wanting it to feel alive inside. She goes on to say, Om Namah Shiva Saha Soham, goddess mantras. How do I decide where to place my focus in order to generate devotional heat? I also wonder and am thankful the question was asked. You mentioned before that those mantras given in this course are empowered. Could you say more about that? And then she says Saha would be empowered then, in question mark.
Yeah, Saha is empowered. It has mojo in it, and it has specific mojo for you guys. You probably noticed that there's a mojo in everything that we're doing. When you listen to the class, something shifts, something awakens. When you do the practices, something awakens. It's because, and I have no idea how this works, but it's because the lineages who pour their awakening intention into the study of this text have poured their awakening intention into the mantras that we're using. So, but that said, if there's a mantra that you have used over time in your meditation that is empowered for you, I would practice with that. So if you're sitting with the mantra Saha, for example, and your meditation starts to deepen, what will often happen is that another mantra will arise, and usually when that happens and you're practicing a mantra that's not the one you're used to practicing, ordinarily when that happens, the mantra that comes up will be what I would call your mantra, or the mantra that is most deeply lodged in your awareness. And when that happens inside meditation, I would just say go with that mantra. And again, for the kind of practice that we're doing in this class, which is, you know, essentially we're doing a kind of combination of Shakta Upaya, Shambhav Upaya practices for looking into how a thought intersects with the mind energy, or, you know, or how the mind energy can dissolve thoughts and ideas, or what it is to feel ourselves as awareness. In other words, we're practicing with a very subtle approach to the mind. So in this class, and in my study of this text, we are working with a mantra as the pulsation in the mind. And let me say a little bit more about what I mean by that. You know, for instance, when you say Om Namah Shivaya, when you say Soha, there's a kind of the word that came up was a kind of a shiver in consciousness. It's like, you say the mantra, and if you're paying attention to how it lands inside your awareness field, inside the mind, you notice that the mantra has a particular emotional energy that comes with it, a feeling state, a kind of sense, a felt sense an inner subtle sensation that goes with the mantra. And in Shakta Upaya practice, in the kind of practice that we are mainly working with in this class, we say the mantra mainly with the intention of feeling into that felt sense, that the sensation of the word unfolding inside our awareness. So the mantra is its pulsation in the mind, not so much the syllables themselves. And therefore, in this class, I would say you should work with the mantra that has the most resonance and power for you at this time in your life, but focus not so much on the sound syllables of the mantra as on the felt sense, the felt experience, let's say the subtle touch that you can feel as the words strike your heart or as they strike your mind. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because I know this is fairly subtle. Okay, I'm going to take your silence for assent.
Well, that was a question asked from the web.
Yeah, oh, okay. So short answer, which mantra feels powerful for you right now? Use that one. Right now in this class, mantra is a convenience. It's not the main focus of our practice. We're using mantra to help still the mind and turn awareness inside so that we can start to look into awareness itself or start to look into the inner body and to begin to experience the texture of the mind, the texture of our awareness. And so that's one thing, take the mantra that's powerful for you. And the second thing is focus not so much on the syllables themselves, but on the feeling, the felt sense of the mantra in your awareness. And again, thank you for the question. All the mantras that I give you in these classes are empowered.
Okay, should we take one from Australia? I think it's Marion.
Hi, Marion. Is that you, Marion?
It's me. It's me, Sally. Yes. Hi, thank you so much for the teachings. I'm very grateful. I have a question about, I read some time ago in Satsang with Baba, in one of those books, that it's good to do sadhana in isolation, to do it on your own. So I basically took that and kind of set off on my own. So I'm very grateful to have you to ask a question of. I prior to being exposed to Siddha Yoga and in the early stages of Siddha Yoga practice, had a lot of devotees that I was working with as a therapist. And
you mean Siddha Yoga devotees?
Yes.
Or are devotees of different traditions?
Yeah. No, Siddha Yoga. Siddha Yoga. Swami Muktananda and Guru Mai, prior to me actually meeting the tradition myself in an intensive in Tokyo. My question is, in working with other people directly on releasing their specific samskaras, do those of us who do that work take them on, the samskaras
take on the samskaras?
Yeah. Because I've had since then a whole lot of really peculiar things, physical things and life things happen, and I wonder about that, and if there's something in particular that I need to do to
get
clear.
I,
other, Does that make sense? Do you know what
I'm... It makes complete sense. I know exactly what you're asking. And the reason I hesitated was because, yes, I mean, the short answer is yes. Whenever we work with somebody, especially when we're doing deep work with them, first of all, as a therapist, you're probably in empathic connections with the people you're working with.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if they're spiritual practitioners, they will generally tend to be more open to release than people whose consciousness is thicker. So you can do fantastic work. And part of the privilege of working with people whose consciousness is more awakened is that your own samskaras get dissolved in the process. So in other words, and I'm sure this has happened to you, that you know someone is going through something, you hold space for them, and then you realize that something freed up in you, you know, because there was some kind of connection. And it's also true, and you can usually feel it, that sometimes someone is going through something very heavy, and the space that you open up for them doesn't fully dissolve it, and some of it comes to you, some of it goes back to them. So the way to work with it is really to deeply meditate.
Okay.
And it's why, you know, especially when you're working with other people, when you're doing therapeutic work or the kind of work I do, it's really, really, a daily meditation is really, really important, because it's as you, and especially the kind of meditation where you're very deeply immersed in mantra, such that, you know, you kind of become so immersed in it that you sort of lose a sense of separation from it, or very immersed in awareness, or, you know, very, very willing to keep returning to a witness state. And that that will resolve the samskaras. It'll clear them out. But you should expect, as long as you're doing this work, that you're going to have to do some subtle hygiene and clear yourself periodically. You know, and I just heard this interview on NPR with a guy who spent some period of time in the space station, and he wrote a book about the experience of being on the space station and orbiting around the Earth. And so they orbit around the Earth 16 times a day, so they get to see how you know, it's summer in Sydney when it's winter in New York, and all the different the changes on the planet. They're close enough to actually see stuff. He said that it's so apparent, and of course we've heard this from astronauts and others, that this planet is one entity. You know, that we're really, really not separate. We are all breathing the same atmosphere. We're all living in the same bubble. So we're always exchanging samskaras to some extent. You know, and it's one of the reasons why when we clear ourselves, it doesn't just clear our field, it clears fields of others whom we have maybe no idea what's happening. So the work you do with people it demands vigilance, and it's also very good for you, as you become attentive to what it feels like to have somebody else's karma in your field and to dissolve it.
Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Sally, it's 6 o'clock. Do you want another question, or?
Well, let's take Christine's question, and and see if we can.
I've unmuted you, Christine.
Yes.
I actually changed my mind, but didn't know how to unraise my hand.
Oh, okay.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And so there's one more person. From Eugene, Oregon.
Hi, Sally. This is Wendy.
Hi, Wendy.
Hi. So your instructions were so incredibly helpful last week. And then I actually have been sort of reading and rereading the chapter on Sutra 10. So I know I'm behind, but I'm still trying to understand the same thing. So, and today I had this really remarkable experience of really experiencing what you were talking about. I can't remember which week, of like, open your eyes and this is Shakti coming into, and then close your eyes and feel it coming into you. And so I was at this concert this afternoon of these beautiful Danish quartet, string quartet, and I just went into this meditative place where, like, I could feel the fingers of the violinist, and I could even, like, that one story that someplace, I don't know if you told this story about that monk who was supposed to repeat a mantra 10,000 times, but then he was kind of crazy, and he didn't do it. And so, like, every time when I chant Om, I imagine everybody in the whole world is chanting it, and I can, like, almost feel it. Like, today I could actually almost feel it when I was in that concert, about how that music was dissolved into not me, but the greater me, and opened into this greater me. It was really a revelation. So I just want to, and I want to say that when I was reading Carrie's note about the resistance, like, it was like I had that same experience of not quite being able to get that, like, how to do that in the external world. And one of the things that Chris talks about in that chapter is try not to do it with, like, the external. Try and just do it sort of with what you were telling me about this subtle internal space. And so even when I was doing that today at the concert, like, this weird thought would come up, and then I'd be like, oh, this thought is forming in this consciousness, and then I could see it sort of fading away. I'm not quite sure where it went, but I sort of felt like I actually had this visceral experience of it. But even that question that that person from Boston, I didn't get his first name, was asking about this idea about being afraid about the world, and, like, how do you open your eyes into the world and, like, feel that part of Shakti when it's so scary, and close your eyes and take that into you. And I just think it's actually, like, only if you just keep doing it. And I mean, I guess that's kind of my question. Like, I think it's part of the concert and all of those things. And, you know, and but it's, you know, you got to start small, I think, right?
You got to start where you are. Yeah, you got to start small. You got to start with your own experience. And then somehow grace enlarges your experience. You had a spontaneous experience of what it is to realize that the fivefold act, that concert is emanating from your awareness and is part of your awareness. You can't make yourself have that experience.
I was so excited that something close to what you were talking about happened to me.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
And I think actually that's like the resistance, like where you're trying to do it, but you can't imagine it.
Right, and you can't make it happen, and it's frustrating. It's beyond your control.
You just kind of start to wonder, like, and that's the other thing that sort of has come up, like, I'm reading all the posts, and I just feel like we all suffer from this idea that we're, like, weird or different or, like, out of it somehow. Like, no matter what people are saying, everybody's saying that. And we're, like, the most coolest tribe ever.
Yes, it's true. It's true. It's
weird.
And part of our coolness is our extreme sensitivity in these respects. You know, they say in the Yoga Sutras, there's a statement, I think it's in the commentary, in Vyasa's commentary, that a yogi is as sensible as sensitive as an eyeball. And this feeling of I'm out of it, I can't get it right, it's part of that sensitivity. And yet, as you say, we get so much right.
Anyway, it was really incredible to, and I feel like I was sharing it with all of you. So I'm happy to have the chance to tell you, but, like, where it gets lost for me out there, like your teaching to me last week about just doing it with my own thoughts, I think is the way that it started to open it up.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, if you do it when you do it with your own thoughts, you actually can see it. You know,
yeah.
It's much easier to grasp. In order to grasp that you're creating the external world, you actually she has to show you.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it feels like, oh, okay, I'm doing this exercise, but it's not really real. But once she shows you, then it's a different story. So I'm interested to know how you play with this awakening in the future.
Yeah, thank you so much, Sally, and to everybody.
Thank you, darling. Thank you all. And thank you all for being here and for these questions, which are really very, very beautiful and powerful. And I don't know if you noticed, but I'm just seeing how as we get deeper and deeper into the text, the nature of the conversation becomes subtler and subtler, you know, on the listserv and here. So thank you so much, all of you, for being here and for holding these extraordinary awarenesses and staying with it when you feel resistance, and for all the experience that is unfolding in you, through you. So we're just going to take a minute to pause, find our posture. And feel how, with the inhalation, Chitti Shakti flows into the body as the life force sparkling with awareness and light. And with the exhalation, Chitti Shakti flows through the body, enlivening every cell and flowing out such that all of us participate in this one great breath. Thank you so much, and we'll meet again on Wednesday. We have one more Q&A session on Sunday. This is we're moving into, actually we have two more weeks because next week is also a practice week, and we're going to be moving quickly into the enlightened stages that the Pratyabhijna Hridayam describes. So I look forward to all that discussion with you. Have a great week. See you Wednesday. Namaste. Good night.